And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me today is...
Scotty Hertz, glad to be broadcasting from the ice planet Hoth. We've chipped everything off of the broadcast tower to come to you today.
By hand.
After days, yes. Our bare fists. Okay, maybe there's a glove on the fist, but... And a hammer.
I know, we're
And a snow brush.
We're so underappreciated.
Everything we could lob at it to make this happen.
More or less accurate.
Yeah.
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and the Spotify. Today, the State of the Union is the same old Donald Trump with the volume down. 45 delivered his latest State of the Union, the first in Nancy Pelosi's house, and the results were confusing. Then Bruce MacArthur pled guilty. He's going to be sentenced for a good long time, but are we going to wash our hands of the implications of his crimes? And then finally, we will talk to Phil Ault about why he tried and failed the transit challenge and what that says about transit in our city. But first... Doug Ford has done it again. And by it, I mean highly suspicious motivations and actions in the Ontario legislature. So this kind of happened almost, I think it was on Friday, actually, the first document dumped from the NDP, where it was revealed that there are changes pending to health agencies. They're going to create a monster agency to oversee 16 different agencies. And then there were further leaks on this past Monday, from the NDP, government whistleblower, who has since been roundly fired, that the PC government is looking at privatizing some programs, including Orange Air Ambulance.
Yes, a whole ton. Now, as you said, we'll call him the alleged leaker, was fired on Monday. They must have used their work computer to send the data out. Leaker is just a word of advice. The manila envelope and printing technique is still a very handy option if you want to get things out
there.
The
Pentagon paper system.
That's just, yeah, exactly. It's just a little bit of an aside if you follow these kinds of things. I sympathize with this person because I love a good leak, for sure. Who doesn't? We media types are like, oh yeah, wow. Now, the Conservatives are accusing the NDP, who are running with this, of fear mongering, and they have said that the papers were a draft, even though I don't think that was indicated. Normally, you see a watermark that says draft.
Yeah.
This didn't look like a draft from what I saw. And, well, I mean, also the fact that they were confidential, most civil servants are under kind of a nonpartisan agreement. It's like you will remain neutral in all matters, regardless of who the government is. And obviously somebody just ignored that completely. But yeah, some of the things that were listed in these documents were the, you mentioned a couple, but the laboratories, inspections, licensing, and medical devices. And I think the argument will be, even though Christine Elliott has said we have no intention of privatizing healthcare, the argument for...
Oh, yeah, it didn't come across her desk.
No, and
even
she
though it was
seemed, oh my
cabinet
goodness,
approved.
She seemed so angry, but, you know, it's difficult to suppress that. She said she'd actually never seen it, right? It's like, it's you wonder who has seen it. I mean, this isn't quite, you know...
Well,
Chelsea Manning level of intel.
The thing says on it, cabinet approved. She's in cabinet. Mm-hmm. And Colin DeMello of CTV like asked her straight up. It's like, so are you like out of the loop on this? And she's like, no, I'm not out of the loop. And it's like, well, you can't have it both ways. It's cabinet approved. And if you're in the cabinet, you must have approved it. So if you approved it, you can't have not seen this before.
I was going to suggest that maybe it was another agency or group has put this together and just was going to dump it to the cabinet. I'm going to drop some names like the Manning Institute or the Fraser Institute. Like, who is doing their policy if it isn't them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is right off the bat, completely suspect, right? So, and of course, as you said, the creation of the super agency, I believe the official name is called the Health Program Initiatives, which sounds really positive. And who's going to oversee it? The deputy health minister and the assistant deputy health minister to be the directors of this new agency. And I think part of the issue with this will be, if it does indeed happen or is intended to happen, is that where we've seen this in other provinces like Nova Scotia, BC, and Alberta have all done the same thing. And it turns out for most of them that they didn't really achieve the savings that they were looking for.
No.
And it kind of threw this whole other lump of challenges, I guess, very difficult process. It would seem in Nova Scotia, it was just a total... It didn't create any efficiencies or save any money like they were planning. That was reported in the Toronto Star.
Well, it's, you know, when does making something bigger create more efficiencies? I feel like this idea, and, you know, considering we have so-called business people, you know, people who are, like, know the ninjutsu of business, mm-hmm. Conducting things, it really seems unbelievable to me that the big idea was to take a bunch of independent agencies running on their own and make it bigger, and you will find efficiencies, because that has rarely worked out, no matter the circumstances, no matter what services are being offered. And it's true in the private sector, too.
Yeah, I think if the approach was that they wanted to make the smaller... or years ago, when the LHINs came about, the Local Health Integration Network, I guess that's the initials, stand mm-hmm. for, mm-hmm. and they that was sort of a consolidation back then, and there were a lot of people that argued against that. So that was, again, a bunch of smaller groupings became an area, and conceptually it's the same. It's just a little bit smaller scale. So this body would cover the whole province. Now, rather than go to the LHINs, which is the system we have now, and say, look, is there any way you can find efficiencies there? Because I can tell you from experience, so many times I was in the hospital, and there seemed to be a lot of people with badges that were just kind of there, and we didn't really know who they were, what are they doing. You know, maybe the intention is to sort of pare that down and say, well, do we really need 10 VPs of this hospital or five? I'm just throwing numbers out there, but there, you know, any bureaucratic system can be top heavy. And as you said, the problem with centralizing it all is it makes it even more top heavy. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. you have an issue, just say in Guelph, who do you go to? How is that delegated out? Are there, you know, what are the categories? And I guess that remains to be seen, but, you know, is that the way to go about it, to sort of, let's say, kill everything off in the LHINs and kind of eliminate that local connection? You could potentially work on the local connection and fine tune that a bit and then consolidate everything. That would make more sense, but they're really big on, you know, these initiatives from above, like everything from consolidating Toronto. So you've got too many people.
Too many counselors.
Yeah. So, this stuff can pretty much run itself. But in actual fact, when it comes to healthcare, which is deeply complex, you know, there is a certain amount of, let's say, local bureaucracy required, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Well, the other piece of this, too, is doing it in the dark. And the part I come back to is, this is the same government that wants to have the most expansive public consultation about the sex ed curriculum, which is one small part of one small class of education, which is part of the big bundle of education curricula. So, you know, for this like sliver of the health curricula, part of the bigger educational piece, they want to have massive, the biggest public consultation in history. But you want to start dismantling 16 independent agencies and putting them into one big mega agency, and you're doing this behind closed doors, and it's up to the NDP to drop documents from a whistleblower. Because mm-hmm. the whistleblower had to have some extraordinary suspicions about just what the full intent of this was, that they would break confidence like that. So, you know, what the heck is going on behind the scenes with the Tories that sex ed, we have to hear from everybody. Rearranging healthcare in the province, we'll come up with that. We'll let you know when we have something.
I strongly suspect, and this is just my opinion, that there's some, as I sort of mentioned, a couple of possible groups influencing things behind the scenes, and I wouldn't doubt if there was a bit of a corporate angle to this as well, in that people that have large investments in healthcare would be interested in doing this kind of thing, which means, you know, essentially the privatization of healthcare means more money for certain parties. leaks happen all the time, right? Leaks,
sure.
But they usually come from the government. But this one is, you know, the fact that this came from a bureaucrat at some level means that they, within that body, were deeply suspicious of what was going on.
Well, there's different types of leaks. There's like the leaks you purposely let out so mm-hmm. you can sort of, take things for a walk and test them out. There's the leaks where somebody, wants to get back at somebody else. We see that a lot in the Trump administration. People are trying to elevate their own position and de-elevate somebody else's position.
The leakers, yeah.
But again, as you said, this is somebody who is part of the permanent political machine mm-hmm. going to the official opposition. And that, we're not even a full year into this government. And they're already like losing the faith of the civil service in terms of the intent. And it's not just about privatization because, there is some element of privatization in our healthcare system already. Think of something like Guelph Medical Imaging here in Guelph. That's mm-hmm. a private.
Or the blood work is
all. Or the blood work too. Yeah.
Life Labs is all.
Life Labs. So it's here, it's real, but people get really sketchy when, you start talking about changing healthcare. And this is no matter who the government is, people have a very visceral reaction when you just, even just talking about efficiencies, even though we don't really do the most basic efficiencies of all, which is to digitize all the frickin' records.
And how long did e-health take? It's still not done. You never hear about it now.
No.
We're still relying on pieces of paper in this day and age.
We're still faxing stuff.
They kept hammering the liberals about e-health, and then you just don't, yeah, exactly. If there's any thing that's keeping the fax machine alive, it's the hospital system, because they will fax that over to me. And it's something to do with something needs a signature on it, right? Like, but you can electronically sign things now, right?
There's ways, right?
Yeah.
Every printer comes with a scanner now. It's so silly. It's just that's sort of like where the basic efficiencies are.
Mm-hmm.
What would it take to just put it all on computers, people?
Yeah, and the other thing too, if your health record was centralized, I guess we were getting a bit off topic here, but
yeah,
then,
no.
Then it would just be continuous. But if you change doctors, you have to pay a fee to send your records over. And I guess if there hasn't been anything particularly wrong with you, or you don't have a chronic condition, there's really no need to do that. You just kind of start over, right? But there comes a time in everyone's life where when the problems start to mount. But it's like it's a do-over every single time. You want to find an efficiency? We just found one for you there, and it wouldn't cost too much, right? It shouldn't.
E-health is.
But this is the thing, is that Ford and Company, and particularly Ford, and Trump does it too, will say, everybody I talk to. But, that number might only be 2 or 3 people or 10 people or 2 people. Yeah. Everybody you talk to isn't. It sounds like it's thousands and thousands of people. It's like, and everybody that talks to me, it's like you could have 3 people talking to you, and that's everybody that you talk to on this topic. And it's just garbage talk, in my opinion, right?
To put us back on topic, Rendell Denley in the National Post wrote an interesting thing where he's like, Doug Ford never tells us what his thinking is. Or really anyone in the PC caucus who are like making these decisions at the cabinet level, why are we doing the things we're doing? What was the thinking? Why are you looking at the changing healthcare this way? Why are you looking at the news broke? It was a Toronto Star investigative piece yesterday about changing eviction, the way evictions are handled. What's the thinking there? And it's just there's part of the trust is just explaining things. And the secondary school stuff is big too. Mm-hmm. Where it's just like we're cutting your tuition by 10%, and then they come up with this cute little animation, and away we go. But it's never the thinking is never explained. Rather, there's never a piece where it's like, we're thinking of this, and here's why we're going to do it, A, B, and C. It's just like, we're doing this, or in this case, we're doing it behind closed doors, and when we have something ghastly to show you, we'll make sure you know, and we'll have a cute animation and a bunch of memes and stuff to
promote it. I mean, the thinking is relatively simple. It's whoever lobbies them and gives them money, whoever has the ear, it's the case of squeaky wheel, we'll get things done. And it's like, okay, just give them cash. And lobby them on something, whether it's sex ed, you name it. You have their ear. You have, you have some numbers, maybe not just cash, but, you know, numbers of people within the party or within the spheres, and then things happen. That seems to be, in my opinion, how they're rolling with this. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see another 4 years of this? Like, what's going to be left, right?
Well,
I don't even think the Harris Tories, who they're most often compared to, worked like that. They weren't much better. I mean, it was, you know, right off the bat, they were slash and burn as well. But I think these guys are going to make those days look like
I think the
birthday party.
Well, if there's a reason, that is because there was a platform that Harris
Common Sense
ran on.
Revolution. Yeah.
Yeah. So
you don't even have to run on a platform now and you can win.
People saw the bat come into their head. It didn't make it any better, but, you know, you were able to brace yourself. But, yeah. You know, I think it's been one of the hallmarks of this government is that we don't know where they're going to...
Buck a beer fail.
Where they're going to
price of gas, not
oh,
you.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that. It's these easy, almost meme-like things.
All right. Well, we've been dancing around the Trump comparison, so let's just talk about the big fool.
Yeah.
So he gave his State of the Union speech on Tuesday, slightly delayed because of the government shutdown that he caused and got nothing for. So it was the first one he did in the Nancy Pelosi-controlled House, who I think sort of remains the winner in sort of the Trump-Nancy face-off. It was sort of fun watching her. I mean, I can't stand listening to Trump for an hour and 20 minutes.
I got to be honest, I fell asleep. I tried really hard to keep it real, but it was just, the droning went on.
Right. And
I woke up in the middle of the analysis, which, you know, was better. It's like, whoa, what happened?
But it was interesting.
It was all a dream.
It was interesting watching her, like, at what point, like, there was a point where he said something and Democrats were booing and she kind of puts up a hand. And they stop booing. And there's
the power. Yeah.
And there's another point where he, I think it was where he said, like, was talking about how great it is that there are so many women in Congress now, even though, like, most of them are Democrats. But so people start applauding this line, and you see Nancy Pelosi do a little flick with her hand,
yeah.
Like, it's okay to get up and applaud
directions.
This one.
That was a weird moment, and in that. There was a bit of levity there because of the cheering that went on, but also it kind of showed that, you know, there can be a moment where everybody's getting along and what he's like, yo, keep standing up because you're going to like this as well. And he kept rolling with it because that's how he is a showman and that's how he works. But it just shows you that, you know, there is the potential for... There's some stubborn ones, though, like
right.
The socialism speech and zooming in on Bernie Sanders. It was so funny. He was like,
that was, yeah.
You could see Bernie turning red there.
There are brief moments when you understand the appeal of Trump.
Yeah.
And there was a clip from The Apprentice years ago that I saw this on TV, but he was like he was talking to one of the contestants who was dating one of the other contestants or had dated one of the contestants and he says, oh, we decided to just be friends. And he goes, oh, I've had a lot of friends myself. Lost a lot of money to having friends. And it's like these moments where he can be like
even funny guy.
Moderately self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes into like, there's people on the border, you know, they're tossing women into the back of cars all taped up, bringing them across the border with the guns. And it's like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was almost as if the speech was written by two different people. Because
yes.
It started off...
Jekyll and Hyde.
Because it had a theme, and I didn't know this, but the State of the Union generally has a theme. And the theme of this one was choosing greatness. So...
How utterly generic.
It sounds like something out of Hamlet, right? Isn't that Hamlet speech? Some are born great, some achieve greatness, whatever. But he had some good line. And the line where it had everybody scribbling, including me, was peace and legislation, not war and investigation, which is up there with any sort of rap line, probably like taking a jab right at Mueller, like right off the bat. I managed to see some of the this thing that they do where they introduce the veterans of D-Day. Buzz Aldrin was there. He didn't punch anybody out.
He didn't punch any.
Which is one of my favorite moments of all time, but that's a whole different story.
Trump's conspiracy theory experience doesn't extend to moon landing fakery, but it was a risky having Buzz Aldrin there in a room full of conspiracy theorist nutjobs is what I'll say.
And then the first, the Right to Try Act was mentioned, and I think some Democrats are clapping for that. That's where if you've lost all hope for any recovery from your illness, you can try experimental drugs and mm-hmm. things such as that. So there, and then so I think somewhere in there it started to turn. when he dove straight into the wall, as you said, or physical barrier or whatever it is this week. And then it just went fast. There was a little bit about infrastructure. Everybody's like, oh yeah, infrastructure, yay. Drug prices are too high. He almost sounded like a socialist, like it's unfair, the drugs are too high. And then he goes boom, right into abortion. The baby right. The baby killers. They're killing the babies, and socialism's bad. And then it sort of comes back. He's like, oh, we're working on peace in Korea and we're going to pull out of these countries. And, you know, there are people definitely, I would say, center and on the left that would say, wow, really? You're going to, you know, there's people like, get out of America, out of Syria. And then when Trump decides to do it, it's like, oh, why is he doing this? Right. You know, it's like,
well, there's
and peace talks. He didn't mention. Did he mention the Taliban by name? I can't remember. But it was like,
I don't think so.
We're in peace talks in Afghanistan. And then we're going to get out. And so he's all over the place, right? But he did dive straight back into that whole Republican, divisive stuff, like the abortion thing. And you could see where the Republicans were doing the USA chant.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that
hated
sounds
that.
So beautiful.
No, it's,
and then the Democrats were just kind of like, oh, this again, huh? So that was and then somewhere in there I fell asleep. But like,
yeah,
wow.
The USA stuff like brought it like right down to the level
beautiful.
Of a Trump rally. So we've
beautiful.
Turned the State of the Union into a MAGA rally. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that.
No hats. You're not allowed to wear. I think somebody, who is it? Ocasio-Cortez slid in a button there of child. But, you know, there's subtle ways, I guess, to get
and
around
her,
it.
Her guest of the State of the Union was the woman who, like, scared Jeff Flake in the elevator. So, yeah.
And Tiffany Trump wearing white. Here we're going to go into G-Talk Daily territory. Tiffany Trump was wearing white. And I was
odd
like,
choice.
I think that's the daughter and she's wearing white.
So odd choice, given that Ivanka was all black.
Mm-hmm.
Ivanka was all black. Tiffany was all white. It's like,
and of course, when they started talking Israel, they zoomed right in on the family Jewish couple, right?
Jared, like, who amended his security forms 100 times.
Hmm.
So he's not a security risk. But yeah, so I mean, that was an interesting little dyad. You know, with Tiffany also being considered like the good daughter because she kind of stays out of the way of most Trump business. They kind of wheel her out for these special occasions or when they're cutting the ribbon on a new Trump property or something. She mostly stays out of it. Yeah, the immigration stuff was disgusting as usual. Although he didn't announce that he's planning on a national emergency, he did say like we need a deal in 10 days. It's an emergency. It's like, well, you know, you don't really count down to an emergency, so that's stupid. The thing with threatening there's we're not going to do any legislation unless you stop the investigations. Well, I don't know who wrote that line. I did it with Stephen Miller because he stinks as a speechwriter, but it. It's a good line, but I mean, everybody was flashing back to Nixon did on Wednesday.
Oh yeah.
Everyone was, when in 1974, the State of the Union, Nixon says like, well, I think 1 year of Watergate is enough. Of course, 7 months later, he's gone.
Done.
So someone should have had the good sense to say to Donald Trump, maybe we shouldn't threaten no investigations in favor of legislation, because people are already comparing you to Nixon at every opportunity. Like everyone who's left over was part of the Watergate investigation. Thank you. Is
so many investigations.
It's presently employed as a cable news contributor. So don't do that. And then the abortion thing. Anytime Donald Trump talks about abortion, it drives me mad because I guarantee you Donald Trump is somebody who said to a woman, take care of it. Because we know, sadly, from all these exposés about his personal life, he won't cover up when he's having sex with one of his mistresses. So I guarantee you. So
that sounds like G-Talk Nightly territory
I know,
as well.
Doesn't it? So I know that in his illustrious career as a famous philanderer, he has I don't know it for a fact, but I think it's true. He said to some woman, take care of it. And of course, this is red meat to, you know, Dingbat Pence, who's sitting right behind him. Pence, who looked like he was sitting on a tack all night. Anytime there was an opportunity to get up and applaud.
He's a bit like an android. He just kind of, yes, ha, ha. Yeah, you know, the evangelicals love Trump. And if you look at his record, you'll say, like, this is... Because he went into the God mode, right? What, the holy image of God, whatever the heck that line was. And yet,
he sounds so fake when he talks religion.
Oh yeah, I mean, certain things were counter that to that too. The bit about we will defeat AIDS, and I know a lot of them definitely have problems. Well, everybody should have a problem with AIDS, but because of the, you know, the main community that has HIV generally, maybe not as much anymore, but back in the day. Most of these people haven't advanced through, or they're rapidly advancing age. Sort of like, oh, it's the gays' responsibility or their fault. And then the girl, when they're talking about fighting childhood cancer, you could potentially edit this two ways. You could edit it and have Trump the sort of center left, and then you could have Trump the right. If it was skillful editing, you could make it seem like he was, you know, an Obama style guy, and then you could make it seem like he was the biggest hawk in the world. It was really, really weird. And I guess that was their attempt at, and I'm saying them because he obviously didn't write this, their attempt at being nonpartisan, right? They're sort of trying to bridge the gaps and we can work together.
Well, it was interesting because there was a Vox piece, New York Times piece. I first saw it on Vox. Peter Baker from the New York Times said that Donald Trump wanted to make the language against the Democrats harsher, like he wanted to be harsher to them.
Give them all nicknames?
Yeah, stuff like that.
He doesn't have one for Nancy. I think he sort of begrudgingly respects Nancy Pelosi.
No, he's afraid of her.
Well, he's afraid of her, but he's the only
one. She's competent and utterly unsycophantic towards
him. She's more like mom, I guess, because he's never given her a nickname. They always say that, you know, he's got a nickname for every woman or every person in his life. But he doesn't have one for Nancy.
Nancy, or so I like to call her, Nancy.
And Chuck, what is he called? Chuck? Does he have one with Chuck Schumer?
If I was in the room with Donald Trump had said that, I would have said, yeah, everybody calls her Nancy. But no, I'm glad you mentioned the AIDS piece because, again, Mike Pence is sitting right behind Donald Trump. Mike Pence.
Painting him. Yeah.
Well, Mike Pence oversaw an outbreak of HIV in Indiana in the year 20, you know, in the 21st century. Because he closed down a bunch of safe injection sites because he's morally against it. And then when it became clear there's an escalating crisis in the number of people contracting HIV, he took a month to basically prey on it and then begrudgingly let all the safe injection sites reopen on a temporary basis. You want to start with helping those cure HIV? Tell your vice president to pull his head out of his rear on this stuff. And it's not being so afraid of gays. It's ridiculous, you know. And the other piece I'll mention is one of the Trump's guests was a kid with the last name Trump. I think his name was Daniel Trump. But he's being bullied at his school because his last name is Trump.
Oh.
And so here we have the First Lady with her Be Best campaign trying to, like, fight bullyism. And, you know, who's on the pulpit but, you know, the biggest bully in the country. Mm-hmm. And there are statistics that show like bullying and racism and all this has escalated since he took office. So it, you know, it starts in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. And the favorite little bit that I heard was that Rick Perry was the designated survivor. So I was like, what, Kiefer wasn't available? Because he'd probably be better off. He'd be better off with Kiefer at the helm, I think, whether he's acting or not acting. Sutherland for the DS, I think, so.
That's rich.
I was thinking, God help America if that's their designated survivor.
But you know what? I gotta think, it's like him or Ellen Chao. I think it's Ellen Chao, who's married to Mitch McConnell.
Uh-huh.
Is the transport. They're probably the two most competent people.
Hmm.
Or the least corrupt. Because, I mean, say what you want about Rick Perry, but there's been no scandals about Rick Perry, really. In terms of his tenure as energy secretary.
That's because you never hear from him. He doesn't say anything, so that might be why.
He must be doing something right.
The quiet man.
The quiet man. All right, we're going to take a break and come right back with some talk about the Bruce MacArthur case here in or down the road in Toronto. And then we're going to talk to Mr. Phil Ault, Counselor Phil Ault about the Transit Challenge. And we'll be back in a bit. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
That was White Horse from their, I believe that's their self-titled debut. White Horse are playing, and that was their version of I'm on Fire by Bruce Springsteen. They are playing Royal City Church Friday, February 8th, this Friday at 8 p.m. as part of Hillside Inside.
There's and a Hillside Inside now?
They're going to be a part of the Hillside Inside. Yes, it's hard to believe.
It's been around for a while.
Flies right on by.
It's
but,
been around for like, this is the 11th year, right?
Is it? It is, I guess so. It's been that many, I can't even remember.
Because I remember getting a press pass to cover for something for the one that was in the Sleeman Center.
So it keeps on going. Lots of lots of brunches.
But that was 2009, because that was So-Called was there. That introduced me to So-Called.
Oh, there you go. There's always something for everybody at Hillside Inside. So I believe tickets are still available. So check them out. Mm-hmm. Royal City Church, 8 p.m. Friday. Be there. And if you see me, say hello. If you know what I look like. But since I'm on the radio, you might not.
And since your Twitter avatar is Peter Parker.
Look for the guy who looks like Peter Parker, but slightly more aged. And not wearing like, a yellow like shirt, sweater.
Even older than Into the Spider-Verse. Because there's old Peter Parker
like
in that.
More like Luke Skywalker now. Without the beard.
Wow, delusions of grandeur over here.
No, just the grizzledness. Anyway.
We want to... not laugh so much, but no. We also want to put a disclaimer in front of this that, you know, since this deals with violence against LGBTQ people, just be advised that we're going to be talking about the sentencing of Bruce MacArthur, the man accused of killing 8 men in the gay village over a period of 8 years. He was active from 2010 to 2018, 8 that we know of. He pled guilty last week. The sentencing hearing was Monday and Tuesday. He will be formally sentenced on Friday. Pretty quick turnaround considering they were looking at a 3 or 4 month trial starting next January, January 2020. At least the part of it is that it's over for the family and friends of the victims. Is it going to be over necessarily for the Toronto police, who maybe still have a lot to answer for?
I don't think so. And of course, this is one of those stories that makes your heart sink. Mm-hmm. It's just that grim. The police definitely did fumble this one. It's difficult to, you know, it sounds like MacArthur was the one that got away a couple of times due mm-hmm. to, I wouldn't say it was the flubbing necessarily of the investigation, because they eventually were able to put it together and track him down. And thankfully, there was a person in his apartment, and they figured he was set up, or this person was set up to be, was going to be the next victim.
The number 9.
So that's how close call it was. And we talked about this before, but the issue, I think, with the LGBTQ community, kind of not even beyond everything else, is that, you know, weeks, I'm not even sure, it was just a couple of weeks before all of this came out, Chief Saunders said, well, there's no evidence of a serial killer in the village in Toronto.
Right.
Even though they were investigating this guy, he had been taken in a couple of times, and one of the police that was investigating him that had effectively let him go after an assault, he's being investigated as well. So there's a lot of, introspection and analysis going on with the Toronto police as to whether they did fumble it. But, of course, when you're dealing... with somebody like this, it has to be stressed that this is rare. This kind of murder streak and the age of Bruce MacArthur. There's a lot going on here where, this is not an everyday occurrence. But, of course, a lot of what had happened, too. I mean, who did he prey on? It sounds like, from what I was able to listen to this, because it's really dark, was that he was preying on people that he figured wouldn't be missed. People that were in the village, that if they disappear, like homeless person and people that were kind of keeping their identities secret,
right,
or were off the grid, or I think at least one person was a refugee,
mm-hmm.
who was, you know, and I guess all this would come out. But yet it's one of those things where he supposedly everybody loved this guy in the village, and he's a small Santa, and he bought us drinks and da da da, and then we have this dark streak which is just beyond the realm of.
And there was one victim, Dean Lisowick, who was never reported missing.
Was he the homeless person, or at least living on the streets?
Yeah, he was like living on the fringes, but mm-hmm. nobody reported him missing.
Right.
And it just, you know, it paints like this ghastly picture of just how vulnerable these men were. A lot of them had wives, a lot of them had children. But, you know, they come from cultures where if it's not... If being gay doesn't result in a death sentence, there are 7 countries in the world where you can be sentenced to death for being gay. You certainly could, you know, be violating the law, because there are about 77 countries in the world that being gay is completely outlawed. So he's not just preying on an already vulnerable minority, which is gay men. He's preying on gay men who are deeply in the closet because of culture. Men who are new immigrants, men who are, you know, living on the edge of society, have addiction issues, or have homelessness issues, what have you. And that just makes it a perfect storm of, you know, when you consider that unfortunately timed quote from Saunders that, oh, there's no serial killer in the village.
Yeah,
it just makes you wonder, like, who are the police protecting if they're not protecting the most vulnerable? And that's a scary thought. And especially coming after the heels of, remember when Black Lives Matter said, you know, people in police uniforms shouldn't be marching in pride because of that history. And many people were supporting police, I think even me, who were saying, like, well, that's the past is the past. And it turns out, no, the past isn't the past. The past is still very much present.
Yeah, because I think one of the things they do is they point to Chief Saunders and say, well, we have the chief of police is black.
Right.
And that sort of, but he's still police. I mean, there's the police culture in and of itself is its own thing. It sort of goes beyond all of the other groups. There are LGBTQ cops, there are black cops, you name it, from the different, one of the most diverse cities in the world, if not the most diverse city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still police culture, and when you have any culture, bureaucratic or otherwise, there's a lot that goes with that. And it took many, many, many years from the bathhouse raids in the early 80s through the AIDS crisis for that relationship with the village, the gay community in Toronto, to improve. And then within the period of a couple of years, as you mentioned, Black Lives Matter and the conflict with the Pride Parade, and now this with MacArthur, among other things, has thrown a wrench into the whole works. And it's the kind of thing where the relationship will take a long time to heal, if it ever does.
Mm-hmm.
But unless the Toronto police do the digging and figure out where they went wrong, now they are having, as I said, this inquiry about the one detective. They need to do...
Sergeant Paul Gauthier.
Yes, they need to do a full... you know, system analysis on how to rebuild that relationship with the community, because it's obviously they failed miserably here, even though they were eventually able to solve it, but at what cost? The other scary thing about this too is that, and I've heard this analysis more than once beyond the sort of sheer creepiness of the whole thing, is that the expert analysis is that serial killers don't just start in their 60s.
No.
And there has been a history of the village. I think there was, I'm going to say 40 years back, there was a bunch of mysterious disappearances. And I mean, in that far back, was say pre-1980s, like in the 70s, when the village was evolving, it was definitely fringe then. And so the police, I guess, to some degree, to their credit, I don't think this investigation isn't over with the conviction of MacArthur. And you would hope that they would do... the only reason really to, well, I mean, we don't have the death penalty, obviously, but to keep mm-hmm. him alive would be to see if they can get eventually anything else out of him. But the Crown's asking for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So parole at 116, knowing full well that he won't be alive. And he'll probably have to be in segregation because he's the kind of guy that would very easily get taken out in prison.
Yes. Yes. I think even 25 years to life, he's in jail till 91. And that's just when he can get parole. Because, you know, Paul Bernardo, who is probably like the alpha in terms of Canadian serial killers, unless we're talking about the Mad Trapper.
Yeah.
He's been up for parole several times. It's been consistently denied. So, I mean, Bruce MacArthur's never going to get out of prison one way or t'other. But this was like, when you hear some of the ghastly details about this, this was like serious criminal mind stuff, like with souvenirs and taking pictures and posing bodies and things. I mean, this is where kind of like the trigger warning comes into play.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is a deeply disturbed person. And yeah, as you said, as the excerpts will note, you don't sort of just like wake up one day when you're, you know, 50 something and decide you're going to, you know, kidnap and kill another human being. That there's something here that, you know, I think may be a significant area of study. And I think that is why perhaps this will not be the last we hear of Bruce MacArthur, that there's more here. And, you know, 9 victims over an 8-year period, the way he disposed of them too. I would not be surprised if we at some point start hearing about more victims. You're right, this isn't the end.
Absolutely, because, I mean, it's entirely possible that I'd mentioned those cases from years ago that he didn't stop.
Yeah.
So he could be potentially responsible for many, many, many murders. We don't know. And that's the thing, is that will they be able to essentially get it out of him, because he had, with the amount of evidence they had and were able to acquire, he pretty much had to confess. It's like but the police had him on everything, the files on the computer, as you mentioned, the trophies, and also keeping the bodies nearby, which seems to be a characteristic of people like MacArthur as well. As I said before, rare, very rare, not completely, you know, he's not the first, but it's not as if, you know, serial killers aren't common in general, let alone in Toronto, let alone whatever. So there's lots of factors at play. But, you know, generally with somebody like this, something happened to him somewhere along the line.
Yep.
Right? You don't just wake up one day
yep.
and do this, regardless of what, you know, every other show on Netflix is based on, right?
Right. So we're now joined by friend of the show, Counselor Phil Ault.
Ex of the show, I guess you could say, right?
Ex of the show.
The old show.
Before we spun off.
And we are a spinoff, eh? We're like the Laverne and Shirley of this place, right? Is that?
That's right. Yeah, and we were happy days.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. That's, yeah, nailed it.
Ah, memories, gang.
They weren't all happy days. Phil, I want to start asking, were you surprised that you took the transit challenge? You were quite candid that as a city councilor, it's difficult to rely solely on transit. And then you did this interview with Craig Norris, but it got national pickup. Is that surprising?
Well, actually, I didn't even know it got national pickup, if you want the truth. I was told after the fact about that. It certainly got greater response than I expected it would have got had I been even remotely successful. But what I've been trying to tell people was that the challenge put out by Shan Matway, whom I have a lot of respect for, was to only use public transit when you needed to go anywhere other than walking. The first day, it literally was the perfect storm. And Adam, you were there. It was the night of the meeting where we didn't end until 12:30 at night, and there was, you know, the mother of all snowstorms. Mm-hmm. And at that point, as soon as I could not take transit, and actually James Gordon said, you know, you're crazy to even think about doing this tonight. that was the end of it. I had failed.
So, Phil, if I got it right that you did, I'm going to say survive, but you did the transit challenge in 2015 for a month. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
And was it the same time of year? I'm trying to remember.
No, it was in nicer weather. I think it was maybe May I'm not certain. It could have been. I know that I did have my bicycle because I actually used my bicycle as well, so that when I got to the end of a stop and I had to go further, I would take my bike off the bus and I would go elsewhere. So I really, with transit, truly was a king of the city. It was great. It worked well. But the real problem is now that with the inclement weather that we've been having, to be able to combine modes of transit is tremendously difficult, and especially with the demands that were put on me in the last week. And to give you a good example, some people said, well, you know, I rely on transit all the time, and I have to go three or four places in a day. But what they don't need to do is that they don't need to go from serving breakfast, say, at a breakfast program where I'm in jeans and a T-shirt and an apron and literally, you know, slopping food on me in some cases, to being required to wear a suit and tie for another meeting, and in the interim, go to, say, St. Joseph's Hospital, to St. Joseph's Healthcare Center, to visit my infirm mom and maybe feed her at the same time. So there were a number of factors involved in that, plus the weather.
And no phone booth to change in anymore, is that right?
No, we only have the Bat Cave where people can park at City Hall.
Ah, right.
You make a good point that if, you know, you're doing two or three different things in a day, that it makes it hard to get around transit. But I think you probably heard a lot of this, too, from in terms of the feedback. There are people who are doing it, and yeah. I think they're... I guess a bit flummoxed that, you know, maybe because maybe they don't have the option to drive like you do.
Yeah, and that's great. And Adam, I know that you're one of them, actually. And that's exactly it. It is the option. And the difficulty, in fact, even Shan Matway said this to me. She said the difficulty really is that if you have other options for transit and you can make appointments that are really tight, you will do that. In inclement weather, what you do if you rely upon transit is you decide not to go somewhere. Mm. Like, for example, today. Today's a perfect example of not going somewhere. Many people just shut down because of the rough weather. Now, what I want to be very clear about is, like, when I said I failed to use transit 100% of the time over the last week. I didn't fail to use transit, which I do use, and which I'll continue to do. And at the end of the month, I'm going to, as closely as I can, provide a monitor of what modes of transportation that I've used in the last month. And as I said, full disclosure, I'm very privileged. I have a car. It's very easy for me to get in the car. That's not what everybody has. And the beauty of failing is that it draws attention to a mode of transportation that needs to be enhanced for all sorts of very good reasons. One, to get people where they work, especially those who have very limited incomes or choose not to drive. But also, there are environmental and economic reasons to do it as well. If we can get people out of cars, we actually reduce greenhouse gases, and that to me makes a heck of a lot of sense. Furthermore, we also increase fitness minimally because people actually do have to walk to a bus stop, and I'm not being facetious about that at all. And finally, the other thing is, if you're concerned about taxes and economics, the very fact of getting people off the road, if we can actually encourage people to use transit more, means that our budget for road building and road replacement and repair can be reduced as our roads are less susceptible to wear and tear. So right. there's all sorts of reasons to do this. And I want to do it. I want to be able to walk from my house to a bus stop. And as Robin Jarris, the transit manager, has said, be essentially assured that unless something goes wrong, that within 10 minutes there will be a bus available so that people aren't frustrated by buses dropping their routes, as we admit happens, or by problems being encountered such as trains crossing major roads that actually take the buses right off their schedule.
I would also add another big piece of that is traffic, especially downtown. A few weeks ago, I encountered a situation where the bus was trying to travel down McDonnell, and there was a delivery truck in the center of the road, and there was a smaller delivery truck off the side, and the bus just couldn't get past.
Absolutely. I see that all the time. And it's interesting. I've got to ask myself, since when did McDonnell become transformed into Spadina? Because it's starting to look like that as the trucks are parking in the middle of the road. And you're quite correct. Similarly, the problem that is going to be faced by university students right now, although transit's addressed it quite well, is the closing down of Norfolk Street.
Mm.
So that the spine route that we have, the number 99, no longer can necessarily go directly down that road.
Right. There's a lot of ins and outs on this, but I'm wondering, from the point of view of a counselor, of a politician, what do you think the X factor is missing? Because I think when we had the meeting about the transit service review last week, there was, and also throughout the last year, we've had a lot of general agreement that transit has problems. And I think a genuine desire to try and address those problems, but there's still that X factor missing in terms of what it would take. I think a lot of people thought that was the service review, but a lot of people who take transit I've talked to, and I would include myself in this, recognize that the recommendations of the service review were recommendations that people who ride the bus have had for years.
Yep. And in fact, really what it is, it's, I call it the will to transit. I just bore the line from Nietzsche, actually. the real issue here is that I think it was in 2010, virtually every one of the recommendations that we passed in 2010 were accepted by council except for one.
Mm.
Put out the money that was needed to reform transit.
Mm.
The real problem is the will actually to fund a transit system. And we've seen a decrease in that. We've seen that the ratio between what we are prepared to fund transit versus what we expect ridership to fund has decreased, so that, in fact, riders are actually paying more. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with people paying for quality rides on public transit. But when we are discouraging people because we can't develop the system because we don't have the funds, and Robin Jarris and I both agree, we need to move from a radial system to a grid system so that not everything focuses on the city, the university, and the power center down by Woodlawn Cemetery.
Mm.
But rather that we have a grid that can move across main thoroughfares such as Woodlawn, Speedvale, Gordon Street, Edinburgh, and those buses can link up and provide people with a fairly seamless form of transit, mode of transit across town. We need the cash for it, and if we don't have it, it's not going to happen.
Well, you heard it directly from the transit Nietzschean, Phil Ault.
The I can't do it kid.
I can't do it. There is no Superman on that. And I got to tell you, it was probably the best failure that I've ever had. Like you said, this being picked up nationally as I can't do it, it's not working.
Mm.
It's far better than truthfully, this was intended, ironically, to be a personal challenge for myself because I want to get rid of a car.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, ironically or coincidentally, Shan Matway put out the challenge the day that I decided to not use the car for a month in order to just get out of that dependency that we seem to have on two cars in every driveway. I said, sure, I'm quite happy to do it. I had fully expected that at the end of the month, I would have found that that I was able to use transit. It wasn't a problem. And that that I would use my car, my wife's car, when I needed to get somewhere in an urgent fashion. In between, I'd find ways to make it happen. It was something that was going to be private. It was going to be personal. I wasn't going to make any comment on it. The failure made it an issue of addressing transit right across Canada. What is it that we're funding? What is it that we're doing? And frankly, I think it should go beyond Guelph Transit. It should really address such things as, how honest are we being with GO Transit, and how honest are we being with Rail Transit throughout throughout the country. Mm-hmm. We're putting people on highways like the 401, which is now three lanes all the way from London to Toronto or more. We're taking land out of service, which we shouldn't be doing. We're affecting wetlands. We should be reducing the dependence of people on the car and encouraging rail transit as well as bus transit.
Well, you, when you fail, Phil, you fail big. And so we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to talk to you about it. And Adam, you as a regular transit user, you have a vested interest in what we do with transit, and I hope that we can do better for you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And I'm afraid that's the end of our show for the week. And it's going to be the end of our show for 2 weeks, because we are taking next week off because of Black History Month programming here on CFRU. So when you tune in next Thursday at 5 p.m., you will hear something entertaining and informative in relation to Black history, and not necessarily two white guys talking for a change.
Yes, which is probably a refreshing change, we will admit.
So you can find us on our website at opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire. Check out our Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And you can hear this in past episodes of the show on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com. And we'll see you next time on Two White Guys Chatting Away. It needs a song now, like Perry Como or something.
That is the whitest person you could pick out.
Yeah.
Random.
Pat Boone.
But DJ Sounds Good to Me is here next at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will see you not next week, but the next on Two White Guys. And we will see you then.